Well, yeah, I mean, I, you know, to the degree that that we had any information about what Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss stood for,
These were the two contenders in the Conservative Party. Yeah, they're the
without
only two.
liking either of them, it did seem right from the beginning that Liz Truss was the worst choice of the Conservatives. And yes, I mean, there's a, you know, there's a thing that I sometimes call neoliberal austerity. So austerity, of course, generally means more taxes and less spending. But sometimes things that they call austerity mean more taxes for some people, less taxes for the rich, less spending for some people, more spending for the rich. Not
Right.
exactly strictly austerity, but it does make the people with the tight belts tighten their belts more.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Rahul, for joining us, helping shed some light, first and foremost, on the legacy, such as it was, of Queen Elizabeth II. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My guest is Rahul Mahajan, the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He teaches at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and he is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for this program. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Are You With Sonali?
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Bus is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I am your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward, and you are tuned in to Civic Cypher.
Yes, indeed. Be sure to stick around. Had a crazy week this week. A lot of crazy stuff going on, so we are going to talk about all of it, not the least of which is PNB Rock. That's tough. And we're going to sit with that. We need to sit with that. It's very important that we do. So we're going to take some time and go over that. We're also going to talk about a lot of the backlash that we've been seeing in, you know, some popular television series. I think that's how I say that. In particular, we're going to talk about the backlash to our new Black Little Mermaid. as well as some other shows, including House of the Dragon, which is a Game of Thrones spinoff, and The Rings of Power, which is a Lord of the Rings spinoff, and the backlash against Black characters who exist in imaginary worlds. We're going to spend some time talking about someone who deserves his just due, the filmmaker Oscar Michaud, a very profound Black filmmaker, and we're going to dedicate our Way Black History Fact to him and everything else. Unfortunately, this week we had to leave a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor, but there are going to be some other things that naturally make their way into this show, because again, it's been a very, very busy week out there. The devil's been busy, as they say. But first and foremost, we are going to start off on a positive note. If you've seen the Emmys, we're going to dedicate our Ebony Excellence to the Emmys. That's all right with Q.
Shall we?
Shall. So, this week's Ebony Excellence, we're going to shout out Sherry Lee Ralph. The article comes from The Atlantic, and this, of course, is sponsored by Hip Hop Weekly Media. In the minutes after the actor won Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy Series, she sang and beamed and inspired the audience to leap to its feet again and again and again. Her acceptance speech was the kind of moment that television, live television in particular, is made for and needs more of. To anyone who has ever had a dream and thought this dream wasn't or wouldn't come true, I'm here to tell you, this is what believing looks like. This is what striving looks like, and don't you ever give up on you. This is what she said. She, of course, thanked her family, her children, her friends, everyone that voted for her. And it wasn't just the speech itself, but, you know, she's a respected performer who's been waiting decades since her start in the late 70s to be recognized on this kind of mainstream level. Many in the room, as soon as her name was called, seemed to understand how overdue her recognition had been, giving her a standing ovation, even as she seemed too overwhelmed to leave her seat. And a win couldn't have been more fitting than for her role on Abbott Elementary, which is a comedy about an underfunded public school where she stars as Barbara Howard, a teacher whom the protagonist, played by the show's creator, Keenta Brunson, admires and considers her mentor. Barbara is a trailblazer. Ralph is the same. And that speech was magnificent.
I want to add, she's such a great actress that I've been upset with her for like 20 years for not letting her fake daughter in a movie sing in the school choir. So I just wanted to point that out. That's how good she is. I'm real life upset that Rita couldn't sing in the choir on Sister Act 2.
That's funny. That's funny. Well, you know, entertainment is a big part of our world and our culture in this country. And so this week you're going to notice that we're dealing with a lot of entertainment stuff. You know, normally we deal with politics, we deal with, you know, policing, we deal with institutions that we consider to be white supremacist or otherwise have roots in white supremacy. But this has been a big week in entertainment, and so we're going to address that. Now, have you seen the trailer for the Little Mermaid movie that's coming out?
I have. I watched it with my beautiful daughter.
Oh yeah.
We're both very excited about what's to come from the good old folks at Disney.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're like me, you saw The Little Mermaid in the early 90s, might have been late 80s, somewhere in there. Yeah, VHS. You know, I was born in 82, so Little Mermaid was one of the Disney masterpieces that came out. Disney would come out with a movie every year and everyone would go see it. It was always an animated movie. And the character was a white red-headed mermaid figure. And there's another movie that I saw. I believe it was called Splash. Don't ask how I know that, because I don't remember anything.
I remember that movie.
Yeah. And it was about a mermaid too.
It right? was.
And the mermaid was a white blonde-haired woman this time. And I think that if you close your eyes and I say the word mermaid, the vision that comes into your head listening to my voice now, the vision that pops into your head is a white woman. Now we, the black delegation, we feel like we, you know, we could be mermaids too. We could be, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's so strange that we don't exist in the imaginations of people and their fantasies and these sorts of things. And when we do, it's such a big deal. But you know what? I'll be honest, because that's just the way the world has been. Oftentimes we don't notice or recognize that we're underrepresented in certain areas, right? And so when I believe to be a group of allies, people who are like, hey, you know what? We need to change this. Why can't Ariel be, but mermaids are fantasy creatures. You know what I'm saying? So we can use our imagination here and we can make a black mermaid and she can be a little girl and go through, you know what I'm saying? These experiences happen to black mermaids the same as, you know, every other kind of mermaid.
Keyword being mermaid, yeah.
So, you know, the group of people that allowed this decision to make its way to that trailer and then ultimately the movie, you know, they thought that this might be something that the world could use. You know, we've seen white mermaids for the entirety of our life, which is why if I say mermaid, this is an example of the Platonic ideal. The image that pops into your head is a white woman with seashells for her bra and a green sort of fishtail. And you don't think of a man. You certainly don't think of someone black. You know what I mean? And, you know, the people that decided to make this change are people that are being inclusive, which we applaud. We recognize the need for that. We want to exist in these fantasy lands too. We want to be represented in these places the same as anyone else. You know what I mean? The problem is the backlash, right? Isn't that crazy? So
the very expected backlash too. Yeah. I'm sure Disney knew that they would get these types of responses.
And you know, if it was the only one, it'd be, I wouldn't be fine, but but this has happened obviously a lot just this month. So this is why we're talking about it. Anyway, I'll read. So this comes by News One. My Ariel is black and she's swimming in white tears. So over the weekend, a trailer was released for the live action rendition of Disney's The Little Mermaid, starring black actress and singer Halle Bailey as Ariel. And of course, the trailer's release has reopened the floodgates and put us under the sea of white tears. We were already put under when it was first announced Bailey would be playing the lead role a few years ago. A lot of people are talking about what's called forced diversity in Hollywood. The author of this article makes a point of discussing forced whiteness, right? Which, you know, for folks who are listening to this, this is kind of what we were alluding to. You know what I mean? It, I'm not saying it was a concerted effort or people got in the room like Ariel needs to be white, you know, in the early 90s or early late 80s. It was just the default setting. You know, why would anybody even think of a mermaid being black? You know what I mean? Because obviously whiteness was the default, which is kind of strange because human beings are black. Meaning that if you like go on Google Maps and search Earth, and guess where the pin is going to drop? Right in Africa, where human beings first evolved with first, you know, consciousness and the first creatures to be able to call themselves human beings. So this should, in theory, be the default, right? But, you know, whiteness is the default in this country, and because this country really sets the culture, global culture, you know, with our entertainment exports, you know, our film and language and, you know, all the other things, fashion, that sort of stuff. I really do applaud this effort of people trying to make Disney, trying to make right some of the wrongs that they have enacted on black people and some of the stereotypes that they've perpetuated over the years. You know, this new, more inclusive Disney is a very welcome Disney, and in my book, my personal, I don't want to speak for you, Q, but in my book, I think that this is something that is very necessary. I don't think that this is performative. I think that little girls will be able to see this and see that Ariel is black. And, you know, white tears is probably a strong term for me. I don't want to see anybody's tears, but I recognize the point that the author is making there, in that, you know, for some reason, it's almost always a certain group of white folks. They tend to be very conservative, you know, very traditional, and they just don't like anything black. In fact, if it's black, they kind of actively push against it. Meanwhile, over on this side, you know, a lot of times we find with our Hispanic brothers and sisters, our Asian, you know, like a lot of communities of color, people who are born into marginalized communities, inclusivity is kind of the name of the game. We kind of, yeah, let's bring more folks to our table. There are some notable exceptions or some people who have ideas that will never make their way to Civic Cypher, and they're just as black as me and you, Q. But for the most part, our black culture tends to be very inclusive. And a lot of times we find that, you know, when it's our Caucasian brothers and sisters, in particular, those who are in positions of power, who actively work against inclusivity and kind of allowing us to exist, you know, and be celebrated, it's very hurtful. And again, if this was the only thing we were talking about, that'd be one thing. But as you know, the list continues. So I guess, do you want to take the next one or do you want me to get it?
I mean, it's sure, you know, the idea that we're not allowed to exist in even fantasy spaces.
It's almost like they don't want us like in their perfect world or imaginary world.
I mean, but that's it. It's not almost like that. It's like that.
It's very hurtful.
This is our imaginary perfect fantasy space. We'd rather you not exist here.
And I want to be clear. This is not the authors or the producers of the shows with this attitude. It's the public that has taken someone else's fantasy, made it their own, and the public, not the whole public, but a certain subset of the public that, you know, just wars against the fact that black people now exist in their fantasy world or the fantasy world that they've been shown or read about or whatever the case is.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that just the idea that I have to get excited, right? Watching the trailer, for instance, for The Little Mermaid with Aiko, that she'll get a Disney princess that looks like her, that I have to be conscious of it. And I wasn't aware of the casting. So when I saw it, I had a real life.
Yeah.
Like I hadn't read the articles or the press releases to know that, you know, she'd be in it. So Aiko's only version of the Little Mermaid will be this one. This will be her first, you know what I mean, interaction with Disney, you know, besides Encanto, which also gave her some pride because, as you know, Aiko's mother is from she's from Mexico. So the Spanish culture, the Latin culture, very, very important and impactful for her. So I'm excited that Aiko will have a much more inclusive representation from all things,
sure,
with regards to the arts and, you know, fantasy than we did as children.
So let's move this on a little bit to something that's a little bit more grown up. We're going to talk about the Game of Thrones spinoff. You watch Game of Thrones?
Of course I watch Game of Thrones.
Me too.
All of them.
All of them. Okay. All right. This comes from Variety. House of the Dragon star Steve Toussaint slams racist viewers. They're happy with a dragon flying, but not a rich black guy. Ooh, that's saying a mouthful. Steve Toussaint is, for those that watch the show, he's a character. You know, I'm just going to tell the story. All right. If you didn't watch Game of Thrones, the original series, there's a family that controls dragons, right? This family, as George R.R. Martin wrote in his books, is a family known by their silver hair and purple eyes, right? The reason that this didn't show up on the screen is because the actress couldn't wear the contacts, the actress from the original series, Khaleesi. I don't know her name. Emilia Clarke, is that her name?
Sure.
All right, let's go with it. All right, shout out Emilia Clarke. She need to know my name. That's the important part. Anyway, this was the fantasy world. And in the original series, none of the family members were alive around. You know, it was just her and her brother, and I think her brother died very early. So she was kind of the last of her clan, right? So this new series takes place centuries before.
It's a prequel.
It's a prequel to the Game of Thrones, right? In this new series, her family is all together and fleshed out and deep, right? And some of her family members or relatives or people from that group of people, her clan or whatever,
her tribe, elders.
Sure. Some of them are black skinned people, right? And guess what? They have silver hair. I'm not sure what color their eyes are. You know, it's kind of dimly lit program, and I'm not really all up in dudes' faces like that, but the silver hair is meant to signify that they're a part of this clan of people, Valyrian people, right? So this is what people have pushed back on. Like, why in the world is this black actor a Valyrian in a show called House of the Dragon, where there are real dragons that fly around,
fire,
and
breathe
fire on people?
Flying dragons.
Right. So none of these people ever existed. This is not a historical account of a family. And, you know, insofar as they can be, they're true to the character. Silver hair. Never said that they did not have melanated skin. And if you look at the guy that's in question, I'm not sure the character's name, but the actor's name is Steve Toussaint. If you look at his character,
he plays Lord Corlys.
Lord Corlys. Okay.
Yes, Valyrian.
Right. Nice. So he is a Valyrian. There you go. This guy is, he looks like a G. He looks like God. You know what I'm saying? He's got like these dreads and they're like silver. It looks like, you know what I'm saying? And you got to understand. Okay. So, you know, Q and I, as we mentioned, we watch Game of Thrones. We got into it. I don't know why you got into it. I'm just into everything that's like royal, king, you know, queen, that sort of stuff. You know, my name is Ramses, my last name is King, you know, and I just kind of grew up that way. You know what I mean? Anything having to do with a castle or a pyramid or something cool, regal, I'm just into it, right? And you gotta know how that hits somebody like me when I'm into a show and I see an important character and he's black in a space where that's not typical, right? So when I saw him, I was surprised. I was like, whoa, right? But surprised in a good way. And I'm sure if you're listening to me and Q's show and you've listened to us for some time, then I'm sure that you probably had a similar reaction. Whoa, how cool is that? That's a good thing. But you need to know, just like we do, that there's people, a very vocal group of people who push back against this. And it's very sad because it's like, okay, you're cool with dragons, but not cool with melanin. Like, how far does this go? You know what I mean? Like,
I mean,
what's more believable?
They're cool with a woman with a fish tail and half of her body being covered in scales.
I'm gonna let Q talk.
As long as she's not black.
Keep on talking, Q, because you're saying that.
You know what I mean? Like, and they treat it as historical fact. Well, Ariel was white. Ariel was a cartoon mermaid. She didn't actually exist at any point on Earth, people. She could be purple or aqua, and people would be fine with that. It's the brown that they are not enjoying. Very, very straightforwardly, the brown that they are not enjoying
is very hurtful. And I think that, you know, I don't want to say to be fair, but if I was to try to pinpoint a source of it, I you know, we've talked about on this show and you know, on the Black Information Network daily podcast, how there's a lot of our Caucasian, mostly brothers, but some of our Caucasian sisters too, that really feel like the quote great replacement, end quote, unquote, sorry, is a real thing. They think that there's a concerted effort for people to replace them.
You know my real problem with the great replacement.
You only have one. People.
It's not singular, but this is the one though.
Okay, go ahead.
They'd be fine with it as long as they're the ones doing the replacing. That's the part that makes my stomach turn, right? It's because, of course, you don't want your race to be wiped out. And if you're dumb enough for someone to convince you that that's true, it could incite fear and panic and distress and anxiety. Sure.
Yeah.
But those same people would be fine if the people being replaced or wiped out or becoming the victims of genocide,
if they didn't look like them,
Yeah. Even in this space where you're talking about reality versus historical context.
Yeah.
When Cleopatra was cast as a beautiful white woman, they were not so up in arms about the historical precedent. Well, Cleopatra was Egyptian and from Africa. She couldn't be Elizabeth Taylor. No such article was ever written by the segment of our entertainment world or the journalist or just the fans and people who are upset. They never were so up in arms about actual historical figures being replaced. You know, a movie called Gods of Egypt was made.
Ooh.
It was called Gods of Egypt. Every star in that movie was white.
I remember that.
Every lead speaking line character in that movie was white.
I remember that one. You know I remember that one.
And that wasn't 50 years ago. This is like 7 years ago.
I'm knowing. But watch this.
Okay.
So we talked about Little Mermaid. We talked about House of the Dragon. Watch this. This comes from CNN.
I didn't know you had another one.
This comes from CNN. Elijah Wood and the original Lord of the Rings cast shut down racist critics of Rings of Power.
One time for Elijah Wood.
Watch this. Amazon Prime had to shut down the comments or like some sort of message board or chat room or something like that having to do with the Rings of Power. I could read this, but you know, I'm going to paraphrase her. Because people were upset that there were black hobbits. This all this stuff happened like in the past month.
I'm not laughing because it's funny, y'all.
So, you know, the Star Wars franchise, you remember that? Remember when the stormtrooper took off his helmet and he was black and everybody's like, "Oh," and that was in the trailer. You know what I'm saying? There's a real thing. And on their side they think, "Okay, why do black people have to be everywhere now? Why is it, you know what I mean? This is what they think." Well, because we exist, you know, that's the answer. But, you know, they haven't seen it. They haven't grown up with it. And to them, coupled with that, what they've been taught, which is they're being replaced. Jews have a concerted effort to organize the melanated individuals of the world to replace white people. This is a real thing that some of these white conservative people think. When they see a black person in a space where they don't expect it in media, then they feel like it's the woke Hollywood liberal agenda to force blackness down their throats. And of course, from where we sit, it's just like, no, we want to exist in these fantasy places. We want to have black skin. We want to go to other planets. We want to fly on dragons. You know what I'm saying? Like, we want to swim in under the sea with Sebastian. And
how dare you want flounder thing?
You know, and this is kind of what we run up against. But it's important for us to share this with you, our listener, because our belief is that by you knowing this, you can have conversations in spaces where our voices don't get to and we physically don't get to. And so hopefully we create better allies.
And now, proper propaganda. Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists with journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
If you're just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I am your host, Ramses Jha.
He is Ramses Jha. I am Q Ward. And you are once again tuned in to Civic Cypher.
Yes, indeed. Be sure to stick around because we still got a lot more show coming your way. I'm not even sure how we're going to really approach this, but we're going to talk about PNB Rock.
Hmm.
If you're listening to this, there's a good chance you're listening on a hip-hop station. This show exists for some real specific reasons, but I didn't want
this moment to pass without us dealing with some real, you know, on this show. So
also before we move on, and you and I can both look into this to make sure that we're addressing this properly. Sure. It's a small thing, but it could be a major thing to someone else. Mm-hmm. I said the word dreads when I was living in Atlanta.
Locks.
And one of my colleagues that had locks corrected me.
Yeah.
Now we can read up on the yeah. proper way to say that and the reasons why, but we said that
the first half of the show,
Lord Valerian
yeah.
had dreads. I want to correct us and say that he had silver locks.
Okay, perfect.
And we will educate the audience on why that's the case on a future episode.
Sure. Locks. Yes, indeed. Right now, we're going to discuss how to become a better ally. This one comes from Major Threads. So shout out to Major Threads for sponsoring this installment. And the article comes via World Economic Forum. This is entitled Four Ways to Be an Ally in the Fight Against Racism. So what we're doing is addressing systemic racism. So take notes if you want, or of course, rewind the show or check out civiccypher.com and download it. But number one is understand that systemic racism goes beyond police brutality. It's much bigger. They're much bigger things in place, long-standing ideals, so forth, that need to be addressed. Number two, speak up against racism in the workplace and support Black colleagues. This one is very important because racism oftentimes festers or is loudest when Black people aren't around. And that's the most opportune time to address it. And if you are a non-Black person, you end up in those spaces and you can hear that. You need to address it. Help us out. Target racism in education. Promote what is known as critical race theory, but really is American history. I saw Roots in the fourth grade. I'm fine. So did everybody else in my class. Number four, petitions and political engagement. Stay involved in the political process and just vote with your conscience. Visit weforum.org to view examples of how to implement and learn more. All right. So now, PNB Rock. Mm. What do you know about this?
Philadelphia rapper, I think current Los Angeles resident, mm-hmm. Someone that the hip hop community not only knows very well, but as you can tell from the outcry, was fond of, not just fans, but even his comrades, his colleagues, the people that he shared the space with, all seem to collectively speak highly of his character and of his person. Him and his lady at Orozco's Chicken and Waffles, I think in East LA, in a neighborhood that, you know, is maybe not right for celebrity or tourism. His lady sharing their location on social media. Some people think that has something to do with it. Maybe him just being followed to the location by someone who had an issue with him. And what I've read was an attempted robbery. I saw a very traumatic video about it, and I was not given any preparation. Like, the person that sent it didn't say, hey, before you watch this, it's this.
I didn't see it.
So I just touched a link and literally saw him lying in a pool of blood.
Ooh, no, I didn't see that.
Dying, but not dead yet. So it was worse. I'm not watching a still person where he's no longer animated and I'm looking at the aftermath. Like, no, you're watching him still, like, try to move. And again, I was not given any heads up. I didn't even know who it was when I saw the video. And then came the stories hours later of people even at that point still trying to figure out if it was who they thought or if it was who some people were reporting. Again, I read what was called a failed robbery attempt that could have just been a cold-blooded murder. I of course have no idea the reasons why, but they could be seen as very, very obvious. When you put people in an environment and you create conditions where there are those that have it all or what appears to be everything, and you put them in an environment where there are those who have nothing, you create a predator-prey environment. And a lot of people, a lot of sources will, and I see a lot of our people speaking up angrily about the black-on-black crime aspect of this story, which I think it has very little to do with. It is a have versus have-nots scenario. It is a proximity scenario. It is a, if you listen to the show, Ramses and I are very, very proud of where we're from. By nature of being from two of the coolest cities on earth, you know, pardon our bias, but our people, and maybe it's by nature of surviving the circumstances we're born into, we're typically really proud about where we're from, not just Compton and Detroit, but Newark and Brooklyn and New Orleans and
Chicago,
the south side of Chicago. Like, I can name cities all over the world where the circumstances are the same. We are the have-nots in mass. Becoming an adult out of that environment where you're born to die, some may say, instills a certain pride in us, right? Very, very proud of where we're from. But I know when I go back to Seven Mile Road, Q, you're from there. You do not still live there, sir. You are of it, or you were in it, but not of it, right? There were some decisions you made that led you to be the father of two, who gets to sit across from Ramses and talk about these very, very sometimes difficult but very necessary things. And when I go back to that space, I have to have a respect for it. There are predators in that space. And when I show up with my glasses on and my well-tailored clothing with any resemblance of opulence, with any resemblance of success, I am now the prey. Even though I grew up in that very neighborhood, there is a respect required for going back into that space that sometimes we don't pay because we feel like we're entitled to be there. You know, I'm from here just like you from here. And I put my pants on one leg at a time just like you. Sure you do. But that thing on your neck costs $70,000, sir. And I ain't got it. And the rent is due in 2 weeks. And my kid's hungry too.
I'm glad you said that, because you mentioned that, you know, I'm from California.
Compton, to be exact. Compton.
I was in California when he was shot. I was there. Shout out to Big Boy. I was hanging out with Big Boy. If you're a fan of radio, he's a mentor and OG of mine. And as
Big Boy,
as we're sitting down talking, approximately the time we were just hanging out at Chick-fil-A, this happened. Not in the same part of town, I don't want to give that impression, but I was, you know, there in that place. And remember, we live and broadcast from Arizona, from Phoenix. So I was out of town. Anyway. Yeah, being from California, there's a particular association that I have with one person who lost his life, who was from the hip hop community, that just hurt me differently. And that was Nipsey Hussle.
Rest in peace, King.
A lot of people will agree, but, you know, Compton is, I'm not going to act like I grew up in Compton. I was gangbanging and this and that and the other. I'm from there, just like you were saying. I'm from there. So I know people from there. I know what the environment is like. I was there in the 80s. You know what I'm saying? So I was there when it was the worst. And then, of course, my family stayed there. So that's where I have to go visit. You know what I'm saying? That sort of stuff. Nipsey Hussle was the sort of person where, like, I get it. I understand. I know why you talk like that. I know why you move like that. You have to. You got to swim in the stream, you know. And for those that know the story, Nipsey was killed by a black man
You know, we're talking about PNB Rock today. You know what I mean? He was robbed. PNB Rock was robbed at the Roscoe's for his necklace and I believe his watch, something like that. And this isn't one of those moments where talking about black on black crime is, there's never a moment when talking about black on black crime is meaningful or matters, because black on black crime isn't a real thing. It is in the sense that a black person can commit a crime and another black person be the victim of it. But in terms of it being some sort of, you know, epidemic sort of thing, it's not, that's not true, you know, any more than white on white crime is the thing. You know, crime is crime and the people closest to you are the ones that get it. You know what I'm saying? If you're a criminal, or, you know, if you live in a crime infested area, you know, if you get in an argument with someone, chances are they're related to you, or you, they know you for a long time. You know, you don't just get in fights with strangers off the streets. Usually you get in fights with people you know. Those people tend to be closely associated with your tribe. And so this is the way that works. So black on black crime as a term is something that was created, and it's meant, the intention is to put the blame for black people's problems in the lap of black people, which in principle sounds like, yeah, that's fair. But the truth is, the effect is that it serves as sort of a scapegoat or a lightning rod. The term black on black crime is a lightning rod, so that, I hate to keep picking on conservatives, but really that's where it comes from. The conservative facet of this country doesn't need to really address the systemic issues created by a lot of their policies. And I'm not going to let the Democrats or the liberals off the hook here either. A lot of times the liberals too, you know, and I'm not saying everyone was intentional. Some people just didn't know better, you know, but this is the truth of the matter.
It's cyclical. Right. There's exactly. there's moments in history where these things were flipped. The roles were reversed.
Sure.
The you know, the Republican and Democratic Party and the way that they approached politics and government, the roles have reversed a bit. Sure. They have not always been in the positions that they're in now, but there have always been conservatives.
That Republican way of thinking,
or not. That way of thinking has always existed.
Right.
It's always been systemically oppressing.
Very good. So really the conversation, because you might be listening like, oh my God, here they go again. But
yes, though, by the way, yes, here they go again.
Yeah.
And hear me again out. Like hear episode next week, we on that.
Yeah.
Just say in that case you, if you just tuned in by mistake and you were flipping through, yes, here they go again.
Yeah.
And next time.
Yeah.
Just so we're clear.
Say it. So watch this. Rather than, okay, here's another example of a black man killing a black man, they're eating each other, they're fighting each other, blah blah blah, rather than having that attitude, that approach, that ignorance, that willful ignorance, that deliberate blindness to the reality, we choose, and many educated people, many people who have a much more broad view of what's really happening tend to look at society. Q made an excellent point when we first started talking about this, haves versus have-nots. A lot of crime that you find in poor neighborhoods is the result of economic inequality. And if you address the economic inequality, the need for crime drops. And therefore, crime drops.
Now, Ramses, being one of the most intelligent people that I know, won't say this because he feels it not necessary, but I will. That does not mean that some evil people won't exist, that some criminals won't exist. But there are crimes that happen as a result of circumstance, uncontrollable circumstance. I am starving. I have nothing, and neither do my children. And those people over there have a lot. I need to go get some of that. That does not make it right. right? We're talking about correlation and causality and the black on black thing and the things that we try to tie to the reasons why things happen, the real reasons why in a lot of cases are reasons that people don't want to admit because then they have to point the blame at themselves,
right,
for not just creating but continuing to perpetuate
and benefit
those same circumstances and benefit from.
Right. So for what we are trying to address, it's necessary to frame this the right way. Now, Q and I are members of the hip hop culture. We're both DJs. We both come from hip hop radio. This is the lifestyle we live, the way that we dress, the way that we talk, the way that we move. And so something like this is going to feel heavy in our world. Perhaps it feels heavy in your world as well. Nipsey Hussle, in particular, because I'm from California and I know, I'm going to just say it, man. I grew up, it was gangbangers everywhere. That's what it is. You know, there's strength, there's protection, there's, you know what I'm saying? And in an environment where there's not a lot and people are fighting over scraps, and you introduce a way that people can make money and, you know, provide for themselves. And this is the CIA that introduced crack into the Southern California black neighborhoods.
Into black neighborhoods all over the country, by the way.
Well, ultimately, yes, but it started in that part of the country. And, you know, now there's more to fight over. And the people that you're fighting to get stuff from, they look like you, they move like you, they walk like you. And then so it's very easy to hate yourself because you're looking for yourself to find the people that are from. And then, you know, even when there's less money involved, now that you've been conditioned to hate these people because they've done something to you, they've robbed you, they've hurt your friend, they've killed your friend, your family, your cousin died, this sort of thing. Now you're locked in perpetual warfare in an environment that there's not a lot to go around. There's not a lot of mobility, of course. And it's like a trap. It's so funny because that word trap has never been too far removed from hip hop. And excuse me. This is why when you look at someone, when you're like me and you look at someone like Nipsey Hussle, where it's like, I can see you, I can see myself. I'm very fortunate in that I was able to move out of there when I was young enough to not have to play that game. I had big brothers, Rocka, Sean, Buddy, Rocka from Dilated Peoples. That's my brother. big brothers that, you know, made sure that I didn't have to, you know, swim in that stream. And then, of course, I moved to Arizona and was able to, you know, the story goes how it went. Here I am talking to you now. But I know Nipsey. I know that person. To see that he made it and he was giving back and he knew what he was into. He knew what was happening. He could see it and he was like, I'm going to fix this. This is wrong. And if no one else is coming here, if this environment has been forgotten, there's people just down the street in Beverly Hills. There's people over there in Mulholland Drive, these mansion millionaires, people driving Ferraris everywhere. And we're killing each other over pennies, over nothing. We're locked in perpetual warfare, you know? And this is why when people look at Chicago, like it's just a black issue. No, there's social, and the reason why, oh God, sorry, my brain is all over the place. But the reason why so many people feel like blaming, Chicago is a lightning rod too. You know, people like, oh, the black people got problems in Chicago. Fix those problems before you start trying to come at the police. Well, listen, if it was easy to fix these sorts of problems, if it was something that you could do in a timely manner, then I don't think we would have as many issues or as much in the way of pushback. But what we do need to do is change the framework of the society and then give it time to implement these conditions. Took a long time to come about. It take a long time to dissipate.
But Ramses, that's the problem.
No one will give it time.
Nobody will give it a shot. Yeah. Too many people benefit from the system the way that it's currently set up for there to be large scale reform and change.
Yeah.
right? That those who are in power benefit the most. So they put things in place to keep themselves in power and keep those who have not under their thumbs. That system has been in place forever. They have no actual agenda or desire to change it. And what we've started to notice when it comes to our politicians is it does not matter which side of the aisle they sit on. They benefit from it.
That's the part that's so hurtful.
There is no actual push from anybody in that space to change it because they all benefit from it.
I'm going to say this. If for those people that supported this show from the first episode, I know you still listen and I know how you feel. And I'm thinking of you in this moment when I say this next thing. Okay. But I have to say it because it's true. The same way I'm looking at this instance with PNB Rock losing his life, and I have to look at that as a societal issue that manifests itself in that way, but also I will not divorce from it the fact that there is an individual who crossed the line. By far and away, crossed the line. He took a life or some stuff, right? That is a violation. I have to say it. I condemn it, of course, and I'm not just going to blame society. That person is very wrong, more wrong than anyone. That's the ultimate crime. He can't come back. He can't raise his daughters. It's end of him, right? I also have to say that I recognize on this show that we deal with systems, and more often than not, we have to talk about policing in this country. But police get to be individuals too, who are also a part of the system. And so I'm going to say this because it is fair for me to be able to say this. And I'm so sorry if you are upset with me, because I know a lot of people are very upset with police, all of police, and they just want to, you know, all that sort of thing. But I'm going to say this. Officer Kevin Gilliland, I thank you for being a kind man. He knows what I'm talking about. Officer Daniel, I thank you for being a kind man. Officer Suzanne, I thank you for being a kind woman. I thank you for talking to me, knowing who I am and the positions that I hold. I thank you for growing me up. I thank you for allowing me to grow you up too, and for understanding and sharing my pain and the pain of my people with you. And just like I have these conversations, I hope that you have these conversations with your audience, with your fellow officers and so forth. In this moment, I will send you my love and hope that we will continue to build something profound and we all will be better for these conversations. And let the backlash come. I had to say it. So moving on. It's time for the Way Black History Facts. The Way Black History Fact this week is brought to you by Hip Hop Weekly Magazine. And we are going to read from IndiaWire.com. Why has Hollywood still not given pioneering Black filmmaker Oscar Michaud his due? All right, let's read. Michaud was one of the great trailblazers in film history, but the industry has yet to fully appreciate his legacy. Time to change that. Black filmmakers have struggled for representation as long as the movies have existed. As Hollywood took shape in the early half of the 20th century, Black directors were already looking for ways to push back on prevailing stereotypes. From the uplift films of the 1910s, produced by initiatives at the Tuskegee and Hampton Institutes, to the naturalistic shorts made by William Foster in Chicago, and the work of the London Motion Picture Company, the first Black-owned film production enterprise in the United States, there was no shortage of examples. The most prolific and tireless voice during this period was Oscar Michaud, who blazed trails in Black American cinema, beginning with his 1919 feature debut, The Homesteader, the first feature film written and directed by an African American.
It's been 90 years since he became the first black filmmaker to produce a sound feature with The Exile. It's been 70 years since his death, and still, Michaud's impact hasn't been fully measured and recognized by Hollywood. As the HFPA faces a major reckoning over its diversity issues, and the awards infrastructure faces major questions about representation, Michaud's underappreciated legacy is worth another visit. Michaud produced and directed films at a time when black people were still considered by a racist white establishment undeserving of their humanity, let alone their freedom to tell their own stories. His quote, "nothing impossible," unquote, self-sufficiency and the DIY nature of his films paved the way for indies that would follow. The child of a former slave and America's preeminent black filmmaker for almost three decades, Michaud started the Michaud Film Corporation and made about 44 films, often as a writer, director, and producer. Like Hitchcock, he often cameoed in his own work. He financed those movies any way he could, including, incredibly, selling stock in his company to white farmers in South Dakota. This was the early 1920s. Considering the racial tenor of the times, it's certainly apropos to wonder how a black man of very humble roots, with limited education and virtually no technical or artistic training, became a filmmaker of note and created a film production company with a reputation that has endured until it didn't. His legacy has not been entirely disregarded. Contemporary black filmmakers like Spike Lee have been vocal about Michaud's influence. Lee even once called Michaud his idol, who inspired him to do his first film. In 1986, the Directors Guild of America honored Michaud with a Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2010, the U.S. Postal Service issued a Michaud commemorative stamp. In 2019, Michaud's masterpiece, Body and Soul, was selected by the Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry for being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. The 1925 race film featured Paul Robeson, then 27 years old, in his motion picture debut. In 2017, HBO announced it would develop a Michaud biopic. Tyler Perry, whose ascent mimics that of Michaud's, was on board to star. Yet Michaud has yet to be recognized in any way by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, aka the most famous and prestigious organization in the film world. That suggests either total ignorance or perhaps a lack of appreciation among the Academy's brass for what he was able to accomplish as a black man in Jim Crow America. But it's time to do something about it. One idea, whether the Academy or another organization goes for it, would be an annual award named after Michaud, designed to celebrate pioneering work of other relatively unknown black artists of yesteryear. There's gold and then there are hills. After all, it's not just Michaud whose career has been rendered inconsequential. During the first half of the 20th century, specifically 1937 through 40, more than 50 black movies were produced. They diverged from the aesthetic of earlier black films like the inexpensive melodramas made by Michaud and depictions of black people in Hollywood fare. The intent was to appeal to the mainstream on their own terms. Many of these films are presumed lost. The average movie buff will likely know about films of black performers and filmmakers who thrived to an extent prior to the signing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, Dorothy Dandridge, and the first black Oscar winner, Hattie McDaniel. But the enterprising work of black actors, producers, and directors like Ralph Cooper, who wore all three hats, also known as the Bronze Bogart and Dark Gable, are largely ignored. Along with white producers Harry and Leo, co-founded Million Dollar Pictures, which produced around a dozen films during that four-year stretch, many of them starring the actor. He launched his career with Dark Manhattan, a 1937 crime drama that adapted the Hollywood gangster formula with an all-black cast. Prior to the film's opening credits, a title reads, "We dedicate this picture to the memories of R.B. Harrison, Burt Williams, Florence Mills, and all the pioneer Negro actors who, by their many sacrifices, made this presentation possible." In 2017, Martin Scorsese launched an initiative to locate and restore classic African-American films via his Film Foundation in partnership with the Pan-African Federation of Filmmakers and UNESCO, dubbed the African Film Heritage Project. 50 films distinguished for their historic, artistic, and cultural value were to be identified and preserved. Ultimately, the goal is to protect essential titles to ensure that new generations of African moviegoers can actually see, appreciate, and maybe even be influenced by them, rather than the deluge of titles from the West that have flooded African markets for decades. Race films like those by Michaud have been neglected in part due to their perceived lack of value and limited reach. It parallels the muzzling of marginalized voices of the period. Note that the 1920s through the 40s had some of the highest concentration of work by Black filmmakers, the likes of which the industry wouldn't see again until decades later. And finally, Black film history is American history, and the seeds planted by Black pioneers like Michaud a century ago continue to proudly yield returns. They deserve to be celebrated, and their trailblazing work held in the same high regard as their white contemporaries. Hollywood is making progress on celebrating current Black talent. Now it's time to take the long view. So that's a name I didn't know. Shout out to our producer, Ms. Maggie, aka Maggie B. Known, for digging that one up for us, so that we could all be a little bit more educated about stuff that we don't know. You know, this is, I mean, we were talking earlier about representation and seeing ourselves in fantasies. It's also important to see ourselves in history, you know?
Yes, sir.
And this is certainly a wonderful example of that. A lot of these Way Black History facts, I know all about them, but every so often the one that I'm like, oh, there's a new one. And today was one such day. So once again, shout out to Maggie B. Known.
She do.
Because she do. But that is going to be that. That's going to do it for us here on Civic Cypher. Once again, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
I am Q Ward.
Yes, indeed. And show produced by Maggie B. Known. Do us a favor. Hit the website, civiccypher.com. Download this and any previous episodes. You can also shoot us an idea for some topics. Anything you want us to talk about, you can make a donation on the website. Or you can hit us through your favorite payment app. We are at Civic Cypher on all of them. We do take donations, and we use those donations to grow the show. We'd like for you to share this content. That is really where we're seeing the most growth. So if you know someone who could stand to use a little bit more game in their life, please share the content with them. It helps us out. If you can't donate, that is the second best way to help us on our way.
Also, subscribe.